Welcome to UBC Insiders On Air for the week of November 20th, 2015, the show that brings you incisive commentary, interviews, analysis, and the best informed rumor mill around on UBC campus life and politics. You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from unceded Musqueam territory. My name is Mayan Kreitzman.
And I'm Neil Janssen. You can always check out our website, ubcinsiders.ca, for written versions of some of what we talk about on air, and an awesome archive full of 8 years of breaking stories and busting balls all over the university.
On today's show, we have our weekly roundup with Madeline Taylor, who is CITR's spoken word coordinator. In our second segment, we'll have an interview with Student Board of Governors reps Julie Van de Valk and Veronica Knott to discuss the UBC Board of Governors. And of course, Neil and I will do a debrief and wrap up. Let's start the show.
To start things off, we've got Madeline Taylor in the studio with us. Madeline is the spoken word coordinator here at CITR and used to be involved in the radio station at Simon Fraser University. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, guys. Good to be here.
So the first news item is that UBC has raised $1.62 billion in its Start an Evolution campaign over the last 7 years. What do we think about this chunk of money?
They only launched the $1.5 billion campaign after they had already raised $760 million of it. So the target was always kind of artificial. And then it was also funny because shortly after they launched that, University of Toronto, not to be outdone, launched a $2 billion campaign.
What does that mean? What are they pointing that money towards? Inform me, I didn't go to UBC, so I don't know what that means.
So the university has an endowment, which is just over $1 billion. And essentially the purpose of that is that they invest that and skim off the interest each year so that the capital of the endowment is protected. And then the additional earnings is invested into various things like scholarships or projects that they have. While I'm sure lots of the money raised in this most recent fundraising campaign went into the endowment, a lot of it wouldn't have. A lot of it would have been donations to things like capital projects. So, for example, however much the Alumni Center cost, basically that was all paid for by donations, and that would have all counted. Since you've come from a smaller institution, maybe we can ask a question that we like to ask a lot here, which is, how much is enough? UBC is in the midst of hiking up international tuition quite significantly. Does anyone think that if they'd raised $2 billion instead of $1.6 billion that they wouldn't be doing this? Or is it basically a completely insatiable appetite for money that they have?
I think it's a completely insatiable appetite for money that they have, and it sort of goes along with the whole neoliberal university as money-making institution model that there's always room to grow.
Yeah, I guess what confuses me about these donations is that none of them really do go into the operating budget of the university, and so they don't really help with teaching, research, the day-to-day activities that happen here. So moving on, should we talk about Louise Cowan?
Do you even know who Louise Cowan is?
She's the VP student. I don't know anything about her, but she exists.
Yeah, Madeline doesn't even know who she is, so.
What do you know about her? Why is she on the list?
She's been VP students at UBC for a couple of years, and it has arisen in the most recent Senate agenda that she is up for reappointment.
So I guess it would be a bit of an exception if she was kept on, given our ongoing leadership crisis and the number of interim VPs and executives that we seem to have.
Just this process starting signals that they're intending to keep her on, because if you wanted to get rid of a position, you wouldn't subject them to this extension review to get rid of them. You'd say, okay, your appointment is done, and off you go.
Is she a positive figure, Neil?
I think she's been doing an all right job. It's increasingly unclear to me what the role of the VP students is, whether it's to act as a liaison from the students to the admin or the other way around.
Okay, the next item is Bill 41. We talked about this on the show a couple weeks ago, I think. So this is a bill which would basically stipulate that students would be able to resign their membership from student societies and thus stop paying certain types of fees. There was a letter sent from a bunch of different student unions that the AMS and the GSS signed on to that was sent to the provincial government. My understanding, Neil, was that this was amended to basically address the concerns and essentially force students to continue to pay student fees regardless of whether they resigned or not. Is that the case?
The amendments addressed part of it, but they didn't address all of it. So what they did is make clear that, for example, a general membership fee for a student union would be protected. But if you look closely at what the Minister of Advanced Education said during debate in the legislature, it was clear that there are still some fees that might not be collected. one of the types of fees that they said would be, I guess, possibly in the lower tier, i.e. not protected, would be things like newspaper fees. And I would assume then the CITR fee would be in that same category too.
Well, there's already an exemption period for students at the beginning of every semester. People do come and have it waived. It's obnoxious from our standpoint. We are already operating under very limited funding circumstances.
And can people waive their fee for the UBC already?
Yes, they can already opt out of that already.
So in that case, like, what would be the difference if you can already opt out of all these things?
What if the UBC and CITR didn't have opt-out procedures? The issue that was being brought up by the NDP and the legislature is, why is the Minister of Advanced Education the one to be essentially micromanaging these and making the decision in the minister's office about whether or not the CITR fee should be opt-outable or not? That is none of his business. And I think that's the thing that's still in the bill that concerns people, and that seems really hard to explain why the Ministry of Advanced Education should want to or need to be involved at that level. Shall we move on to what seems to be happening in the history department and the creative writing department?
Yeah, so these are two stories that are kind of unfolding right now. In the creative writing department, the chair of the department has been suspended. No reasons have been given.
Well, the reason is that they're investigating serious allegations, of which, you know, they pretty much understandably can't say. They can't prejudice whatever investigation is going on.
But at the same time, they list all of the counseling resources that you might want to go to if something awful has happened to you. So there's a lot that you can infer.
And what would those resources be?
Counseling services, the Equity and Diversity Office, the Dean's Office.
Right. So the implication seemed pretty clear that it has to do with harassment or bullying or assault or something along those lines. Obviously, nobody can report on it until somebody comes forward with specific allegations. There's been ongoing sagas all over universities about the types of processes and how fair it is for the accuser and how fair is it for the accused. And do you know anything about how that works at UBC?
From what I know, there is no uniform process for fielding sexual assault claims at the institutional level. It seems like each department deals with it internally.
And to be completely clear, we do not know that the situation in creative writing has anything to do with sexual assault. The university has said only that there are serious allegations being investigated, and we don't know any more at this time. However, we have become aware of some sexual assault allegations made in the UBC History Department. Again, I should stress very strongly that these are only allegations at this stage, but there is a public Facebook post out there from a former UBC student that should be very concerning to anyone who reads it. What does it say, Mayan?
A graduate student in the History Department had been serially sexually harassing people in the History Department, and that multiple women had come forward to report this over a couple of years, and that nothing had really been done about it. And so now they are opening up to the media, publishing his name. There is a documentary on the Fifth Estate, which is reporting the story, apparently. But I'm wondering why they haven't talked to the media before now.
I've heard rumblings about this for a little while, and from what I understood, there were conversations with media, but they wanted to give the department a shot at responding to it first. What she mentioned in the post is that they started to respond once the media started to poke around.
And they did talk to media, because that documentary that you're discussing on CBC, you know, didn't just come about. It's been in the works for a little while, and I wonder if the timing of that post on Facebook was related to, you know, the story's getting out anyway, so might as well go for it.
We were in touch with a couple of people from the History Department today to ask if maybe some of them wanted to come on the show, and we will be talking with them next week. So we'll get to hear the voices of these women and to ask about the details of what happened within the History Department and get the full story.
I find myself annoyed often when I hear about these stories, and this is me speaking personally, not as a representative of CITR, when these stories are broken. And I mean, I understand that everyone is innocent till proven guilty as far as the legal system is concerned, but usually there's so much that happens behind the scenes before anyone hears about these sorts of things. That's part of where I think a lot of institutions fail insofar as they don't have a uniform policy for processing issues of sexual harassment and sexual assault, and it results in confusion and a lot of stories going unheard.
Is it a good thing to establish processes within a university as distinctive from just using the court system like anybody else in the country?
There's a lot of self-preservation on the university's part when it comes to suggesting that students go through their channels rather than legal channels, but at the same time, legal channels are no more accessible than what exists at the university level anyways. There's not like a clear path to justice for survivors of rape and sexual assault. And
that's pretty demoralizing.
Like, it is, but it's also true as far as things are right now.
And UBC is trying to develop those guidelines for a pathway, essentially, for victims to report.
I'd be curious to see what it is.
And the other thing is that we're taping this before the documentary airs on CBC, so there could be lots that comes out of that that we just don't have at the moment.
Well, that's it for News Briefs this week. Thanks, Madeline, for coming to talk to us and providing some insight on something that neither Neil or I are great experts in.
Well, I would definitely not call myself an expert, but thank you for inviting me.
Are you hosting an event on campus? We are UBC's Emergency Medical Aid Team, a UBC peer programs, and we provide free first aid coverage for events organized through UBC clubs and organizations. We cover events such as Storm the Wall, Day of the Longboat, and Residence Life events. We also offer tailored workshops about a variety of first aid and safety topics to the UBC community. If you would like to request coverage for any of your events, find us at students.ubc.ca. If you would like to request workshops, please email us at emat.coordinator@ubc.ca to get in contact with our team.
Our guests today are Julie van de Valk and Veronica Knott. Julia and Veronica are both engineering students who have been elected by the students of the Vancouver campus to sit on the Board of Governors. After months of pestering them to be on the show, we're excited that they finally agreed to come on. Welcome to the show, Julie and Veronica.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Let's start with first things first. There's a board meeting next week. Do either of you know what's going to be on the agenda?
We have not seen the agenda yet, but just from what we know is coming through the UBC pipe, we have a few ideas.
Yeah. So we have international tuition increases coming back, as well as the varsity strategic plan.
And then everything else will be a surprise to everyone, you two included.
Well, we're hoping it won't be a surprise, and we'll find out this week. And we got a lot of reading to do, so...
Okay, well, let's just start from the beginning. So in the University Act, which is the law that governs public universities in BC, it provides only a single instruction for board members, and this is, the members of the board of university must act in the best interests of the university. How do you guys interpret that duty? Do you want to start, Julie?
Sure. That is a big question, and that's the question I try to ask myself every day. Every day that I take a look at board things is what is in the best interest of the university. Something I've really found since getting onto the board was I've learned a lot about the different pieces of the university. I came from a very student-centered background, and that is still, I think, the primary piece of the university. But I've gotten to learn about how the student sector interacts with the whole world that is UBC. And when making decisions around board things, it's really about putting the interests of UBC before any of my own personal biases and thinking what is best for all the aspects of the UBC community.
Yeah, I guess to follow up on that, back a couple months ago, we had a show with some former Board of Governors reps, and Tim, who used to be on the board, said that every new board member gets sat down by the university council and gets told this, essentially as a sort of way to neutralize them. Did you experience that?
I don't think we experienced it in that sense. We definitely were told a lot about our roles and went through a lot of orientation. I actually felt that when we were welcomed on board by other board members, they said to us, we really want to hear the student perspective. To be honest, that was kind of the first message we got from board members was, please tell us what students are thinking and what they prioritize.
Well, that might follow up to the next question, which is the board code of conduct goes even further to make clear that due to the fiduciary duty to do what's in the best interests of the university, even though you have been elected by students, you're not necessarily there at the board table to represent students in a traditional democratic sense. So I'm just wondering, do you see your role as being any different than any other governor, given that your duties and the duties of any other governor are identical?
There's something interesting, and that's that the interests of students aren't different from the interests of the university, because the interests of one sector and of critically important sector of the university are the interests of the entire university. So I really think that by representing the university, we are representing students. From a financial standpoint, no one at the university is saying, let's get all the money we can from students and not look after their interests. There's a very balanced approach to finances and students, and it is really, we're all on the same team.
Can I just add to that, though? Like, we all are on the same team in the board duties and the way we act, but I will say that our roles are different in the way that, like, Julie uses this, and I love this analogy, is that we're like a megaphone for student voices to the board, and board sees that and respects that, right? And it's always, Veronica, Julie, Jeff, like, what are you thinking about this topic, especially if it's student-focused? And so we are different in that sense.
But doesn't that just absolve other board members of the duty to actually ever talk to students?
No, I wouldn't say, because it's not a written duty, right? It's just an added aspect of what I think that our jobs are.
But Julie, I just wanted to challenge you on the idea that we're all on the same team and the university's interests are the student interests. I mean, that sounds aspirational to me, but I just think that that is a fantasy. Like, obviously students have protested and had reasons to do that throughout the history of the university. And it seems like you're sort of putting a gloss on that.
I've been one of those students, so any gloss I put on it is really non-intentional. It's just the way that I've seen things working in this role is that the university is trying its best to look after its students. And one of the ways, for example, it sees looking after its students is making this the best university that it can make it. And they think that a tuition increase for international students is a part of that picture of excellence.
I think that what we all are on the same team that we want for what's best, but that's why we all have our individual vote about what's best, right? Like, I, in June, opposed the proposal because we didn't believe that's what's best for university.
So you guys already mentioned voting against the international tuition increases. Why did you vote the way that you did?
This was something that was a very difficult decision for me, and obviously I put a lot of time into it. I could say, like, emotionally, in spirit right away, I obviously wanted to vote no, but I thought a lot of time about why I was going to vote no. There was a combination of things. The first thing that I expressed at board was I didn't necessarily feel that this was the role of board. I felt that as board, we should be supporting the wills of admin. So if the administration and the deans really wanted the increase, they should be coming forward instead of board mandating it. Another part was I was really concerned about diversity, and I didn't think we'd thought that through. In 2009, U of T started similar increases, and in about 4 years, their number of American students dropped from 10% to 2%. Their number of students from Asia shifted from maybe 40-50% from China to 75% from China. So they were really struggling with the geographic diversity, and you could see that in their enrollment numbers. And so when I saw those numbers, I got really concerned about it, and that was a big point that I brought up.
And do you have any confidence that those issues of diversity have been addressed in a substantial way?
Yeah, so far, I mean, we've been attending the consultations, and I can't say we've seen anything to kind of answer those questions, but we haven't seen the proposal yet. And so I'm really hoping to see something that's substantive towards that when we see the proposal next week.
And the AMS is now running a campaign against these increases above and beyond the type of input that they could give through the official consultation. And we actually just saw Veronica, she was having a meeting in the pit with somebody from the AMS who's leading that campaign. Will you guys be participating and coordinating on that campaign?
I don't see that as our role as board representatives, just the same as I have not involved myself in other campaigns. I think it's really important for us to be someone that can sit at the board table and reflect an unbiased opinion.
I'm not really understanding this idea of unbiased. The AMS is our student government, so, like, what would be biased about talking to them and figuring out what they're up to?
I guess biased wasn't the right word to use there, but to be someone sitting on the board without any conflicts of interest. For example, you can't sit on an organization and also be a part of a campaign lobbying that organization.
Conflict of interest for the board is fairly narrowly defined in terms of personal benefit. And so it would have to be something that one of you personally benefits from, not simply just having an opinion that doesn't jive with what the university is doing. That's not considered a conflict of interest as far as the board is concerned.
I would say, though, that, like, I met with them to get an understanding of what they're doing and how they're doing it and what they're trying to achieve, because it's really important to understand their campaign and get to know their objectives and really hear the student voice. And the best way to do that is to talk to the organizers.
So now that those softballs are over, let's get to everyone's favorite topic, or at least my favorite topic, board transparency. The board seems to have conducted business at a growing number of unscheduled and undisclosed meetings this year. How many of those have there been since you both started?
I don't know.
Too many to count?
Neither of us have a tally.
I would say it's more very ad hoc. It's not that we're regularly dealing with business in unscheduled meetings.
Well, let's take the most famous example, which happened in the wake of Arvind Gupta's resignation, which was discovered by the UBC. And it was very clear that there were a number of board members there, and the meeting went on all day. Why would a meeting like that not have been disclosed publicly that it was occurring?
I think that the time when meetings aren't disclosed is when there's nothing on the agenda that doesn't fall outside of Policy 93.
And that's just the open versus closed board meetings. But the point remains that you can disclose the existence of a meeting even if you can't discuss the content of the meeting.
You can agree with that. I mean, we're not the ones who make the decision whether or not to make a meeting public.
But you could let people know that it's happening.
I don't think either of us even thought to do that.
I do want to push this point because even if for whatever reason the board thinks they shouldn't disclose these things, you guys could disclose them. Why haven't you?
So I think that it's a really good point and it's something that we need to work for. I think when we had the GSS president, Tobias, come into a governance committee meeting and it was one of his points is why board doesn't release this information, and I was a very strong advocate to support that. I will say that since that governance meeting that we had, we have not had any other unscheduled meetings that week, so we haven't been put in that position.
That governance meeting that you're referring to also took place in secret.
So I was told it was in open because I asked explicitly whether or not it had been put in open, and I was assured by the governance chair that it was in open.
But the date, time, and location and agenda for that meeting is nowhere to be found on the board's website, so doesn't mean anything if it's not actually disclosed. And do you both at least recognize the fact that there's been two regularly scheduled meetings since you both came on board, but what we're hearing is that there's an uncountable number of informal behind-the-scenes meetings that have occurred since then. From a public perspective, that it can appear as if there's two decision-making tracks, one open, but then there's this whole other back channel where a lot of things are happening that no one knows about and even the existence of is closely guarded.
It's not back channel in we're kind of influencing open decisions. It's more these are topics that cannot, due to personnel, to legal reasons, be discussed in public. And I wouldn't say uncountable. I would just say we don't want to give you a number without actually verifying it. I recognize that it seems like it is very back channel, and I would say the board is trying to improve that, and board's made commitments to that. And I agree that we probably have not done enough to remove that feeling, and we're definitely trying to improve on that.
More on the topic of transparency in general, Neil filed a Freedom of Information request a while ago, just requesting contact information for current board members. And it turned out that contact information, including email addresses, were basically entirely considered private information, even though board members conduct board business using those private emails. We were wondering if you think that it's appropriate for board members to be essentially unreachable.
I would say first off, and this is something that's really important, is board members aren't unreachable. You can email the board, because we are one body, at bog@ubc.ca.
Like, and who does that go to?
Goes to our board secretariat, who then forward it on to board. And every correspondence to board is either forwarded on or it's put as part of the docket. At the end of every docket, this is a fun fact, is we have letters or emails from the general public, and they're attached at the end of every docket. We read every single one of those. Second is that I also support the idea that we are one body. We make decisions as a group.
Okay, I'm going to cut you off. Do you think that it's okay that individual board members are unreachable?
We aren't unreachable. We can be reached through the board.
You two can be, but the rest of the board.
But we can be reached through the board email.
No, but individual board members not going through the gatekeeper system of the secretariat.
But I think that having one system of communication for the board actually ensures, in a lot of ways, a level of transparency so that we ensure that everyone who is on the board has the same information coming into their email. And I think it's also respectful of the people who volunteer to serve on the board.
I understand what you're getting at, but I guess what you've also described is a one-way system of communication where members of the public can communicate with the board, but they can't really get a reasonable reply. is there a way in your mind that people are able to have actual conversations about issues with the board?
To be honest, I think that should be improved. And I think that everyone should try to work on that and try to open that up and try to have two-way conversations. I would be in full support of doing things to facilitate that. Because I think that the board is missing out on gathering insight from those two-way conversations.
I also asked you guys why you hadn't spoken to the media for those couple months during the leadership crisis at UBC. I think you guys basically replied that you wouldn't have anything else to add. And especially, I remember this, somebody said, quote, "I thought it would be easier not to say anything." I don't think that you guys couldn't have added anything. It's not exactly reassuring.
First off, it was me that said that, and I was flustered, and I don't think I expressed myself in the right way because I didn't mean it in the sense that it was easier to not say anything. That wasn't what I was trying to get across. What I meant was I couldn't express more, and so then, therefore, it was easier to just not do an interview instead of just going online and saying, "I'm sorry, I can't say anything. I'm sorry, I can't say anything." We've definitely learned how to handle things differently and have a different level of comfort when talking as members of the board.
I think that the whole board learned as well that people are really passionate about what happens at their university and appreciate communication.
Wait, is that some sort of a revelation? Like, seriously?
No, I don't think that's a revelation. I think that we were just reminded of it. And with Dr. Piper as our president now, hearing that from the people who are invested in this university, I think was really great. And she's been exceptional at continuing to do that and opening communication and making sure that things that are enclosed really need to be there and saying, what can we do to make this a more open conversation?
But is that going to change? So one of the other things that the board often does is have discussions in closed session and then make their decisions publicly. What good is it for the decision to be made in public if all of the reasoning for why that decision is made happens privately?
But there was a commitment, and Martha's made this very clear, that basically that to remove or minimize that so that all of our discussions happen in open, especially if our votes happen in open.
Maybe you can move on. One of the common complaints about student board members is that they're sort of easily manipulated or intimidated into joining in. And I was wondering if you feel that kind of pressure.
Have you met Veronica? I think that neither of us ever feel as though we have to agree with a decision that's being made.
Especially as young women, I was wondering if you ever feel any sort of old boys club mentality.
I thought I would, to be honest, and it was completely opposite. They've been such, like, empowering people, and they respect us so much as human beings, and I was genuinely surprised by that.
Okay. We've run out of time. There's still so much more to talk about municipal governance and John Montalbano and Rennie and power sharing with the Senate and other topics we would love to talk to you about. But in the meantime, thank you to Veronica and Julie for coming on and taking some kind of tough questions.
Thanks, and we'll just have to come back for round two.
So Neil, let's do a bit of a debrief. What do we think of our illustrious board reps?
I think we did not get to nearly the number of topics that I hoped we'd get to. But
yeah, what I really wanted to ask them was, you know how John Montalbano basically said that the board had asked him to stay on and they had full confidence in him, but he was only kind of stepping down in order not to be a distraction. I would have loved to know if they had confidence in him.
But again, that's our bad for not getting there. And, you know, we focused on other things. I'd love to have them back or other board members to keep asking about things like that. My attitude towards a lot of the things is I'll believe it when I see it. Supposedly renewed commitment to transparency. Great to hear them say that. Not sure if it's actually going to happen.
I was a little disappointed maybe with Julie. She seems to think that Martha Piper is fantastic. She thinks the board and students are on the same team and have the same interests, and essentially seems to think that everything is just A-okay. Veronica was maybe a little bit more direct in her answers, so I appreciated that. Well, that's our show. I'm Mayan Kreitzman, and you've been listening to UBC Insiders On Air, broadcast on CITR 101.9 FM and podcasted at ubcinsiders.podbean.com. You can follow us on Twitter at UBC Insiders, check out the blog ubcinsiders.ca, or email us. Thank you, Neil.
Thank you, Mayan, and we'll talk to you next week when we'll be speaking to at least one woman from the history department about the allegations of a sexual assault there and the university's response.
Insiders out.